This is Jim in Texas, and this is podcast number 4, Civilian UAVs Considered Idiotic and Other Thoughts. I have been participating in some discussions on some of the mailing lists I'm in, and I thought I'd make a little brief podcast. No recordings of flight this time, just my thoughts. Before I get into the main subject of this podcast, which is my thoughts on the civilian use of unmanned aerial vehicles, I wanted to go back to the last podcast where I talked about my little non-emergency with the gear light in our Cardinal. Oblivion, from the excellent blog at Rotula.net, posted a nice comment on my comment section, and it got me to thinking about the past. I had forgotten my only serious emergency of my Air Force time. When I was in the Air Force, I was an F-111 navigator. Before that, I was in F-4s and flew about a total of 1,000 hours in the F-4 and about 550 in the F-111 and EF-111, most of that in the EF-111. Well, I didn't really have any serious bad emergencies during any of that flying, although most of my friends did. I was very fortunate. My Air Force flying was extremely uneventful. However, I did have one problem that's worth mentioning, and that was a serious configuration problem. I was flying at RAF Upper Hayford. I was an instructor navigator. I was flying with a pilot who had very little EF-111 time, and he had never seen the ground in England. He'd flown with an instructor pilot, I think twice, to prove that he could land the airplane. And then this was his third or fourth ride in the EF-111 in England. And I was his instructor, even though he was the aircraft commander. That's the way we did things. Well, it was a nice clear day, and in fact, it was the first time he'd seen England from the air, because his prior two flights had been in heavy, cloudy days, and he'd only briefly seen the ground when he was taking off and then landing. All the rest of the time, he'd just been on top of the clouds to do his work. So we go out, and we fly nice low level, and we explore England. I show him the sights, and we learn the procedures for flying in England, the air traffic control system, and who we talk to. We come back to the RAF Upper Hayford base, and we fly a whole bunch of visual patterns. I want him to see all the visual landmarks and fly as many of the visual patterns as we could while we were there. Well, on our last one, we turn final, and I think after pitching out, he starts to sweep the wings forward a little bit, and as soon as they hit 26 degrees, what is supposed to happen is two leading edge slats are supposed to extend. Well, there's a problem. Only one leading edge slat extends. I'm looking at the indicator, and for 500 times or so, I had seen this slat indicator go to from up to both. It was a little sign. Well, this time it went to barber pole. And I looked at it and said, what's with the slats? And he says, I got a problem. And I look out my window, and my slat's not down. And I lean over there, and I says, is your slat down? He says, yeah. I says, we've got asymmetric slats. Well, what happens in the F-111 in that case, the whole wing flap slat system locks down and doesn't move. So whatever wing sweep you've got set, the F-111, it was a variable geometry airplane. It could change the sweep of its wings and had lots of lift devices on the leading and trailing edges of the wings. Well, all of these things just lock into the position they're in. Well, we go through the checklist. We wind up figuring out we're very light because we're getting low on fuel. It was the last landing of a beautiful day, so we did not have a lot of fuel left, only enough to fly just a very few minutes. And so turns out we have to land at 200 knots and take a departure in cable engagement. So we do that. We take the cable engagement. Well, I don't remember being the least bit scared, even though it was kind of a dicey situation. The pilot was pretty new, and he probably relied on me more than a more experienced pilot would to help guide him through the checklist. But basically, it was a question of following the checklist and taking the appropriate action, just like it was in the Carter when that light didn't come on. So I was thinking, why wasn't I upset in the F-111, whereas in my Cardinal I was very upset when that green light didn't come on? Well, I think it's because in the F-111 I knew that if we could just get it on the ground and get it into that cable, that I would just, they would send a van out to the end of the runway for me. Me and the pilot would get into the van, we'd ride back to the squadron, and we'd have a good story to tell our friends at the bar that night, which is, in fact, exactly what happened. Well, if I had really had a gear problem in our Cardinal, it would have been an entirely different situation. Yes, as I discussed, I could have gone back to Bergstrom, Austin Civilian Airport, done a gear-up landing possibly, had a crippled airplane on the runway there. And as I said, I've researched this and knew that they had the technology to come out there with an airbag system, lift the airplane up, and probably we could find a way to pull the gear down and have it towed off the runway. But I'd be in charge of all of that. There would be no walking away from the airplane. I'd have to sit there and stay with that airplane and get it off the runway somehow and pay whatever it costs to do that. And I have no idea. I suspect it wouldn't be cheap. The fire department wouldn't charge me, but everybody else would, I'm sure. So I'd have to organize the whole thing, then I'd have to get it back to our hangar, then I'd have to explain all this to the club members, and then we as a group, and with me, the guy who pilot who did it, would probably have to take the lead. We'd have to get with the insurance company, file a claim. The airplane would be down for months. People would be unhappy. Get the darn thing fixed. It would have been a year's worth of work that I didn't need. So I think that was one reason I got so upset when that gear light didn't come on. Whereas in the F-111, it was just a question of let's get it on the ground and then we'll be heroes and the poor maintenance guys will have to fix the airplane. And that's, you know, so owning your own airplane or even a part of an airplane puts a whole different perspective on problems in the airplane that you don't get when somebody else is paying for the airplane. All you got to do is get it on the ground and then turn it over to maintenance. Well, so that's one reason I think as airplane owners, or in my case, part owner, I might have more of a tendency to get emotional than perhaps I did when Uncle Sam was buying the airplane. Well, enough about that. Just a few, that's sort of a postscript to the last one. The main thing I wanted to discuss for this podcast was civilian use of unmanned aerial vehicles. For those of you who are pilots, maybe have been to the AOPA website or otherwise aware that in Arizona, they have put initially a pretty good-sized temporary flight restriction. They reduced it a little bit along the border so that they can fly a Hermes, so they, the Transportation Security Administration, the big they, can fly a Hermes drone. A Hermes 450 drone is basically a light sport airplane. It's got a Rotex engine, it's got a rotary diesel engine of about probably 100 horsepower. It goes about 70 knots. Its main operating altitude, and these are from the Hermes site, is 9,500 feet MSL, although it can go much higher. It's basically a powered sailplane. For a fuselage, it's got a piece of PVC pipe. It can stay up a long time. And the TSA is going to use it to surveil the border. Well, I think it's crazy for civilian agencies to fly UAVs. In the military, they need unmanned aerial vehicles to do missions that are too dangerous to send a human pilot into. Plus, another advantage of a UAV to the military is, as I'll discuss in a minute, they can have the pilots for the UAV in Houston and the UAV itself over Iraq and control it by satellite. Well, that's an advantage to the military, a big advantage, because they can keep people at home, but they can have them fighting in the war by remote control. But the main reason to have a UAV is if there's people on the ground with heavy weapons who will shoot at you, and a good chance you'll get shot down, it's better to send a machine in there than something with humans on it who have pink, tender little bodies that don't take well to bullets. Well, we don't really have that. At least it hasn't gotten quite that bad yet on the border. There's really no economic justification that I can see for these civilian use of unmanned aerial vehicles. The only technical advantage that this Hermes drone and others of its type have are that they have longer endurance. This is because they're basically powered sailplanes that get really great gas mileage, and they don't have the frontal area of a pilot, so they can use a 12-inch PVC pipe for the fuselage, basically, or a 24-inch PVC pipe for the fuselage, and put the sensors and the gas into those, and have much less frontal area, so in a long, high aspect ratio sailplane wing, they can fly a long time. They still need pilots. The Air Force uses something called a Predator, which is very similar to the Hermes drone that the TSA is using. It's powered by a Rotex engine, I believe, 100 horsepower, payload of 300 or 400 pounds, very similar in performance to a light sport airplane, except for the long endurance. The Air Force, I know, requires that the operator of the Predator drone, if he's going to fly it or she's going to fly it into civilian airspace, has to have a commercial pilot's license with an instrument rating. And that person has to be there to operate the drone. On the mailing list I participated in, the Moon Eagle mailing list, one of the drone fanatics was saying, well, you know, you don't have to hire a pilot for these drones. They take off and land, fly autonomously. Well, they sort of do, but they really can't do that. You can't send an airplane into the civilian airspace just following a GPS steering system on an autopilot, which is what he means by autonomous. A lot of light planes now can do that. Any airplane with an autopilot, Garmin 430 GPS, and something called a GPS steering box, the pilot can program in the route of flight, and the airplane will fly it hands-off the whole flight. Drones have auto-landing systems. In fact, my brother works on an auto-land system for 20 years. I've worked with him a little bit. I'm familiar a little bit with these systems. They're good systems, but they crash a lot more than a human airplane does. Accident rate on drones is much higher than a manned airplane. So what we've got here is a light sport aircraft that has the sole advantage of having a 12-hour endurance. I submit that a Cessna Caravan, which has God knows what, a 3,000 or 4,000 pound payload, well, you could easily put not only the pilot, you could put the sensor operator in the airplane. The sensors, of course, the same ones are better ones probably than on the drone because there's more space and weight for them. Probably cheaper because they can weigh more and take up more space, so you don't pay for miniaturization as much. And you could probably still load in enough aux gas tanks into a Cessna Caravan to where it might not fly 12 hours, but it'd fly 6 or 8, maybe 10 at minimum airspeed at 9,500 feet while the pilot and sensor operator drive up and down. You can certainly get an 8-hour sortie. And I suspect that 3 Cessna Caravans probably are the same price or less than 1 Hermes 450 drone. And they have the big advantage of not imposing costs on the civilian users that you're supposedly protecting by taking away huge swaths of airspace just because you want, as the bureaucrat, want to play with a new toy. Again, I don't begrudge the Air Force and the Army and the Navy and the Marines and even the Coast Guard from using unmanned aerial vehicles in combat, both for real combat and for practicing for combat. That's just something they've got to do. There's no excuse for the Border Patrol not to buy a darn airplane, hire a pilot, and fly it up and down the border. It's not that expensive. And certainly, you could buy a motor glider. You could do as they did in Vietnam and modify light planes. In Vietnam, they had a number of Bonanza and other light plane-derived airplanes in the what they call a Q-series of reconnaissance vehicles that were basically like the Hermes or Predator drones, except they were manned. Big power sailplanes that could carry sensor packages. You bring those out of mothballs. The thing is, by having a pilot in the airplane, A, it's not going to crash on landing nearly as often. B, you don't have to put some high-tech, expensive collision avoidance system in it because you've got a pilot with eyes. C, you're hiring a pilot anyway. The only difference is the pilot now is in the airplane instead of sitting in a control van. There's just no advantage. It makes no sense for the Border Patrol to buy unmanned aerial vehicles. It's a new toy. It makes them feel good. Maybe gives them that good old G.I. Joe feeling. It makes no sense, and it's a waste of taxpayers' money, even if you don't consider the cost to other airspace users that will be incurred when they wall off big chunks of airspace to fly these idiotic drones in. The last thing I'll mention is special interest to Texas pilots. The Texas National Guard, in fact, President Bush's old unit at Ellington, is going to convert from F-16s to Predator unmanned aerial vehicles. They're going to have 30 of them. They're recruiting right now, I think, over 1,000 people, if I read their webpage right, to operate these drones. Now, they will be able to fly combat missions, quote-unquote fly, from Ellington because the Predators has a satellite link that can, so that the Predator can be anywhere in the world, and the operator can be anywhere else, and the operator can still control the Predator. That's actually a good thing. It means that many fewer people have to deploy to the sandbox. They can stay in Ellington and fly these missions and just deploy the airplanes themselves and the ground crews. So that's good. I do wonder how the Houston Terminal Control Area and Houston airspace, very crowded airspace with lots of airports, lots of activity there, is going to handle unmanned aerial vehicle traffic. There's lots of restricted areas on up and down the Gulf Coast of Texas. There's huge ones. I was trying to plan an Angel flight from Laredo to Houston just the other day, and that's what got me to thinking about this, because you can't fly from Laredo to Houston. There's walls of MOAs and restricted areas. You've got to go way out of your way. And according to my flight planning software, it was a 20% increase in trip length to avoid the existing MOAs and restricted areas between Laredo and Houston. Well, I'd like to think that the military will figure out a way to use their existing airspace, of which they've got tons, to practice with these drones. I'm sure they need to train on them when they're flying out of Ellington. They're going to have to fly them out of Ellington. They can fly maybe from the Class B into some of the restricted areas or Gulf over water areas. I don't know. I have a sad and sinking feeling in my stomach that that's not how they're going to approach it. I have a feeling the Air Force is going to approach it of, okay, we need to fly our Predators. We want to fly them out to West Texas to our bombing ranges out there or out to Fort Hood. So we'll just ask for a TFR from the edge of the Houston Class B airspace that's going to be 20 miles wide and 3,000 or 4,000 or 5,000 feet thick. It's going to go for 150 miles to the Fort Hood range complex or to some other range complex and back. And we'll just throw this thing up there, and the bug smashers will just have to work around it. Who cares about them? They're just a bunch of rich playboys anyway. I sure hope that doesn't happen. I want to emphasize I haven't heard that attitude expressed by the Air Force. But I haven't heard a word from the AOPA or the Air Force or the FAA about how these Predators in the Houston area are going to be handled, and it worries me a lot. But the Air Force needs the Predators. We need to figure out a way to accommodate that. That I will grant. I am a retired Air Force officer. I do appreciate the need for the military to have fairly large sections of airspace. But what I don't appreciate is the Border Patrol getting unmanned aerial vehicles for the simple reason of they're a shiny toy, when a manned airplane could do the same or better job with probably almost certainly fewer people, because all you'd need is the one pilot to fly. You wouldn't need a pilot in the control van and one or two communications technicians to run the communications link, because obviously if the communications with an unmanned aerial vehicle are broken and it's in the civilian airplane system and flies out of its TFR, because it's out of control now, because of a malfunction, you've got a real serious potential emergency with this unmanned airplane flying around civilian airspace. It might even cross paths with one of the Holy Airliners and not just inconvenience a bug smasher by colliding with it. Well, that's enough of a rant. If you have any thoughts on unmanned aerial vehicles, good, bad, or indifferent, particularly as they operate in civilian airspace, I'd love to hear them. In any case, this is Jim. I'm in Texas, and thank you for listening.